We're talking with Jim Steinmeier about two books that are out. He's got a piece of both. The book is The Book of the Damned. It's a reissue of the collective works of Charles Fort. And Jim has also written the biography of Charles Fort, the man we credit as being the originator, or I guess the inspiration for the term Fortean times. That is, he was a collector of the strange and the unusual before anybody had even thought to do it. I mean, sure, there was the odd conversation now and again, or did you see that in the paper? But he's the first one that put all of these damned facts together. These facts of news stories gathered from around the world, verified as best as he could, into one book, which essentially rattled the tree of accepted wisdom. That's why it's called The Book of the Damned. These stories, which are, you know, living on the outskirts of accepted science, except on this show now many years later, which, of course, we spent a lot of time talking about. And he did it first. So Jim Steinmeier has gone through, pulled a couple of examples of the writings of Charles Fort from back then, from The Book of the Damned. We'll give you some real 4 or 5 star examples of what he was tracking back then that we're still following now. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So back with Jim Steinmeier, who has participated in the reissue of The Book of the Damned. And I made an assumption, actually, that it's been out of print. I thought it was. Has it stayed in print all these years and
I just didn't know about it? I think it's been in print almost continuously since 1941 when it was reissued in different forms, I mean, different combinations. This is kind of nice because it's all been put together again.
All right, that's what I thought. So this is sort of the unabridged original version,
right. Plus
your commentary at the beginning. So thank you for going back and pulling some of these examples of the writing of Charles Fort on what we would call today the supernatural or the paranormal. And we wouldn't even blink at it. We'd be like, wow, cool, another cool paranormal story. But at the time,
you have to understand, this is 1,000 pages, these books, you know, in their compiled form. And he writes about, you know, and many, many subjects that kind of catch his interest and puts them all together in a kind of bewildering way, and has his own little theories to talk about with them. I mean, this is what you'll see in here, for instance. I mean, some of the things that I've gone by and made a note of, but I'll talk to you about some of the things that appear in the air. But, you know, you'll see spontaneous human combustion, poltergeists, people who attract fires, people who attract accidents. You know, strange coincidences. I mean, those form a lot of the, as his books, the later books seem to favor those sorts of phenomena. The early books are principally astronomical phenomena and strange things that fall from the sky. He's particularly attracted to this incredibly strange phenomena that seem to be coincidental in the sky, you know, explosions in the sky without explanations, rocks that fall from the sky, not meteors, rocks, falls of rocks. Including there's an account in Book of the Damned of rocks falling in slow motion that were observed by several people.
Can you give me an example? Is there anything that your finger falls on?
Well, I will. Since you asked about, since you talked about people in the sky,
yeah.
In his book New Lands, he talks, there are a number of examples of very strange phenomena like this. For example, he says, October 28th, 1812, phantom soldiers at Havre Park near Ripley, England. This is according to the Edinburgh Annual Register, 1812, volume 2, page 112. When such appearances are explained by meteorologists, they are said to be displays of the aurora borealis. Psychic research explains variously. The physicists say that they are the mirages of troops marching somewhere at a distance. Then, of course, he has other accounts similarly of human forms. He talks about something on October 3rd, 1843, in Warwick. I've got to check the notation here. It's in Warwick. He says that Charles Cooper heard a rumbling sound in the sky, saw a cloud under which were 3 human forms, perfectly white, sailing through the air above him, not higher than the treetops. It is said that the beings were angels. They were male angels. That is orthodox, Fort says. He's saying, of course, that's what people would say, they're angels.
Right, just kind of throws in that little comment.
That's right. He's got lots of those.
Yeah.
The angels wafted through the air, but without motions of their own. And an interesting observation is that they seem to have belts around their bodies, as if they had been let down from a vessel above, though this poor notion is not suggested in the pamphlet. They, quote, moaned, unquote. Cooper called to some men who were laboring in another field, and they saw the cloud but did not see the forms of living beings under it. Then, of course, he writes about, you know, strange visions in the sky, and he, I think one of the oddest of these, and you know, it's a typical Fort kind of comment. March 16, 1890, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon of March 12th, in the sky of Ashland, Oregon, was seen a representation of a large unknown city. Observers thought that they recognized Sandusky, 60 miles away. Quote, the more superstitious declared that it was a vision of the New Jerusalem, unquote. May have been a revelation of heaven, Fort says, but for all I know, heaven may resemble Sandusky, and those of us who have no desire to go to Sandusky may ponder that point.
but an interesting, very funny observation from Fort, but at the same time, interesting that he should say those people who saw that, those who are superstitious, would think of it as a New Jerusalem. So again, making the kind of cutting comment that anybody that was religious was superstitious.
It's very strange because, you know, and I have to say this book, I've sort of had to smile seeing people react to Fort again, because Fort is really an ink blot. He has so many kind of theories he teases us with that people kind of project what they want to see on him. I've had people comment, you know, that I got it completely wrong because what I didn't understand was Fort was completely a skeptic. He didn't believe any of this stuff. And I've also had people say that I was much too sympathetic, that he was a complete crank and he believed in all of this stuff. And, you know, why wasn't I more critical of him than that? So Fort is anywhere between, you know, a true believer and a complete disbeliever. And it's kind of in the eye of the beholder because he's so oddly skeptical and so strangely and insistently agnostic about all of these facts and science and religion and philosophy and everything else.
Well, again, though, it's sort of interesting that we're kind of talking about the spirit of two different books. I mean, in the Book of the Damned, you can't help but look at what Fort says and wonder what he means. At times, it seems pretty consistent that he's really antagonistic toward people of faith. And then to read your book, he is, for all of his antagonism, and I think you do write a sympathetic biography, but in a way, I don't know how else you would. I mean, he's quirky. He's a damaged guy. He's full of weird flaws. I mean, you almost kind of, in the end, you almost have to be sympathetic to him because he'd already been through so much. You know, he'd already had such a crummy life in so many ways.
Well, I also think that people, you know, I think now, especially with the perspective of a little time, you know, we can look at his theories, I use them quote unquote because they change throughout the books and his examples or his suggestions, as he says, and we can be critical of them, and I think we can also maybe be critical of some of his, you know, notes and the way he uses sources and say, well, he didn't quite understand this, or he overstated this, or he understated that. And I don't know, you know, Fort never set himself up to be a researcher. He didn't pretend to be a researcher or a scientist or a psychic investigator. All of those titles have all been given to him since his death, because he started this. But, you know, what he wanted to be was he wanted to be a writer. And he was a brilliant writer. He found a new kind of book to write and found an amazing and an amazed audience at an important time. And I think that's why I'm sympathetic to him. You know, I think I can be skeptical as well about some of the things that he was writing about, many of the things he was writing about. But I think that I'm not skeptical about him personally. I think that he was a kind of, as you say, a slightly damaged fellow who had this revelation and found a kind of wonderful, slightly frightening way of looking at the world and intrigued the rest of the world with it.
Well, give us a few more of those intriguing passages then from the Book of the Damned too, because I'm really enjoying that. And it's amazing to hear stories which we might have put on our website yesterday. I mean, they're
right.
Still.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I mean, these things, and they continue to be written about, you know, in later books. They were taken right out of Fort, many of them. He writes, yeah, I mean, this is, you know, this is just kind of to make your head spin of, you know, how you're supposed to keep up with him. You know, he writes that when he writes about blood falling from the sky and gives several accounts of this, you know, in quick succession, in various places all over the world and over various time periods, His suggestion then is that our whole solar system is a living thing. The showers of blood upon this earth are its internal hemorrhages, or vast living things in the sky, as there are vast living things in the oceans, or some special thing and a special time and a special place, a thing the size of the Brooklyn Bridge, it's alive in outer space, something the size of Central Park kills it, it drips.
Oh, God, that's great.
So, of course, you know, you don't know whether you're supposed to laugh at that or cry,
right?
Because, you know, it all seems to be making sense. And then, of course, obviously he's kind of tugging your leg, but then you say, well, it makes as much sense as anything else. And then, of course, he says things that are just there to probably scramble you. In the middle of all of this, when you say, you know, what are his theories? He says, I believe nothing. I have shut myself away from the rocks and wisdom of ages and from the so-called great teachers of all time. And perhaps because of that isolation, I am given to bizarre hospitalities. I shut the front door upon Christ and Einstein, and at the back door hold out a welcoming hand to little frogs and periwinkles. I believe nothing of my own that I have ever written. I cannot accept that the products of minds are subject matter for beliefs.
Mm.
So, of course, you don't quite know what to make of anything he's written at the point at which he says, nothing I've ever written is something I believe.
He creates his own paradox. And what's even more, I think, interesting for at least if you read the biography of Charles Fort and then you read the Book of the Damned, these two books we're talking about with Jim Steinmeier, is you walk away from Fort, at least I did today, every time I kept putting the book down, I kept thinking about this guy. I kept wondering, like, what would he be like today? What would he be doing today? And I think, in a way, he kind of missed his era. I mean, he would have been reveling in the sort of post World War II era where we challenge everything. This post Watergate era where we're suspicious of everybody. I think he would. This is like so perfect for him. He wouldn't have been swimming against the current so much as he was in the 1920s.
It really is interesting that, you know, so much of kind of the thinking has in this area has caught up with him. And I think the confusion at the time is that he was the first, and people were scratching their head over this. At the same time, you know, he was kind of amusingly a technophobe. He never owned a telephone, said he used a phone about 10 times in his life, didn't like traveling very far from home. And one of his friends observed that if Fort's theories ever became popular or mainstream, Charles Fort would be the first one to then turn and work to disprove them. So he certainly was contrary to the way everyone was thinking, and I think that's part of it. I mean, one of the things he wrote, for example, he says, belief in God or nothing in Einstein is a matter of fashion, or the college professors are mannequins who doll up the latest proper thing to believe as a guide to their young customers modishly. I conceive of nothing in religion, science, or philosophy that is more than the proper thing to wear for a while.
Mm.
And, of course, you really can't disagree with any of that.
Well, I mean, it just sounds like something that somebody blogged about yesterday, you know,
right,
and felt very fashionable and cutting edge when they said it.
Right. Know? And here's a guy in 1919 writing that. Yeah.
Right. Really sticking his neck out at a time when it meant something for him to go against society that strongly and that publicly.
Right.
And the Book of the Damned, it's out with a collection of the other works of Charles Fort. So give us a couple examples of stories from the Book of the Damned. And then after we do a break here coming up, I do want to talk to you a little bit about magic, if that's okay.
Okay.
And then we'll get to calls on any of those subjects in the last hour. But some other stories that we kind of owe the prototype of to Charles Fort.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, he certainly influenced a range, a small collection of science fiction stories in the 40s and 50s, which were really Fortean in their themes and in their inspirations. And one of the things that, for instance, that he wrote about, one of his speculations, which is there again, I think, just to make you scratch your head, is that after he writes about these airships in the sky, and he wonders what they could be doing and why they're there, he suddenly starts writing, I think we're property. I should say we belong to something, that something owns this earth and others are warned off. Pigs, geese, cattle, first find out they are owned, then find out the whyness of it. So, of course, that led to a number of science fiction stories that took that absolutely as the inspiration and were used by other writers.
Why didn't H.G. Wells love him?
H.G. Wells was a defender of science, and what he picked up instantly in Fort, I think, was Fort's critical eye to the scientists, that science had been elevated to a priestcraft. That was basically what Fort was saying. People had elevated scientists to a kind of level where they didn't doubt anything they were saying, that it became the new religion in a modern age. And Wells took offense to that, because Wells was kind of a man of science, and he thought that was a snipe at scientists who were doing very hard work. And he thought that Fort didn't appreciate properly what scientists were doing. And I think that was the reason why Wells particularly took offense to him. He thought he was a damnable bore, in his words.
Yeah, that's odd, though, coming from a guy who then would, you know, cop a lot of similar themes.
Well, absolutely.
In his own fiction
and using these themes, you know, brilliantly.
Right.
Yeah. So, I think it's interesting, you know, how much of what Fort, much of kind of Fort's thinking and Fort's writing was kind of cutting edge at the time. But of course, it was jarring to read it, you know, it collected in these books with these oddities.
Have we ever confirmed blood falling from the sky? Has anybody ever gone through the collective works of Charles Fort and tried to verify what actually has been proven since he originally wrote about it?
I don't collect these facts. I don't actively collect kind of Fortian facts, but I have to say, while I was working on this book, I noticed things, you know, in Fortian Times or in articles or on websites, and I made note of them. And while I was working on this about a year and a half ago, there was a fall of blood. It was in India, and I'm sure that if someone were to do an internet search of this, they can find the story. It was newspaper stories. And of course, what happened now here's what we get to do. Someone takes it to a lab. Blood.
Confirmed blood.
Not red sand. Now, I don't know what the explanation was. And of course, like many of these stories, you know, the story ends there. But, there was a little bit of modern science applied to it.
You know, it was funny. I was reading these two books of yours. By the way, I just Googled it and it came here. March 18th, India police capture blood draining gang. That can't be it.
No.
Hold on. I'm trying to see whether any of the other versions of the story pops up. Let's see. Blood Sky Western Stories. No. Blood. No. Can't find it yet. But I'll keep looking for it. But the interesting thing for me is I was reading these books about Charles Fort. While I was hearing more about this story out of Phoenix, about how a guy had created this UFO effect over Phoenix by tying four weather balloons together, and then underneath that, he attached, I guess, some flares. You heard about this?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, first of all, I don't know. I don't know why it occurred to me the other day, but how come that guy's not arrested from Homeland Security? If you can get arrested for, you know, for putting up a little smiley face icon that glows in the dark toward traffic, if you can get arrested for making odd comments and have Homeland Security, why would Homeland Security not arrest a guy who tied four weather balloons together with road flares and set them up over a major metropolitan city?
With incendiary devices, yes.
With incendiary. Why? Why does he get a pass? Why do we still not know who he is? Why isn't he in front of a judge when other people would? So it made me think, and in my own sort of Fortian way, that story is a cover story and it's totally bogus. Because otherwise I would think, you know, unless Homeland Security is telling us we can now tie incendiary devices to balloons and let them go over major cities and we're A-OK with them, I'm totally suspicious. It made me think about the airship stories. All right, so then we'll get back to the magic discussion, and we'll pull a couple other examples, too, from the Book of the Damned. We're talking with Jim Steinmeier on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Very interesting conversation we've been having with Jim Steinmeier, and I'm going to veer it off course for this segment and then bring it back in next hour when we go back to the phones. You can talk about Charles Fort. You can get into Fortian Times. We can talk about the classic stories that we are still following, developments, revelations, hoped for facts, confirmations about the stories which Charles Fort wrote about starting with the Book of the Damned and then in subsequent works. And we'll also throw into the mix there a conversation about magic. That's what Jim Steinmeier is also an expert on stage magic, helping to develop some of the better known works that you may even have seen performed. I want to talk about Hiding the Elephant, one of his other books, and some of the themes about magic as we know it. Maybe it'll tie back into Charles Fort's hope that there were such things as real wizards. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Jim Steinmeier and I were talking about magic in our first hour of this discussion, and I was relating to him that a lot of my knowledge of magic comes from my old college roommate who runs this website called InsideMagic.com. And I'm always curious. I go there and I realize, you know, there's just this level of understanding of magic that I'll never get to, and or magicians or the whole magic thing. But I'm intrigued by one aspect of it, and I've never stopped being that, is whether or not there ever could be something which we call magic, which is actually part of our natural world. And this is partly explored in the movie The Prestige, which attempted to link those two concepts, that there is somehow the ability of science to do things which in our minds, our feeble brains, can only be computed as magic. Jim Steinmeier, you've been working in this field for a long time. Will there ever be a time when we'll be able to do the illusions that people like David Copperfield and you create, but actually do them, quote unquote, for real?
Well, I think historically you'll see that some of those things have already happened. In the sense that some of the things that magicians, would have done decades ago, a century ago, have been achieved in some form, you know, by science.
Give me an idea.
Well, I mean, certainly some of the images that are now formed, you know, some of the things some of the illusions that you would have seen a century ago couldn't be done today because science has already surpassed that. You know, projected images, television images, identifying something with your fingertips, you know, there are now ways of passing information and putting images on stage that actually have made those tricks obsolete. That doesn't mean that magic has stopped. I mean, that's always happened to some extent. And so what happens is that magicians have come up with new presentations, new kinds of illusions that then impress an audience. And they can also use that knowledge of science. They can use what people are now familiar with and then turn that over and make that a new principle for an illusion.
Oh, that's interesting. And that seems like a separate thought. So I'll go back to the other one.
Okay.
First, that you're talking about, like, through cell phones and through miniature electronics and stuff, that the average person can do things which would have fallen into the realm of stage magic a couple of years ago. But it doesn't seem like that big a deal.
There are always tricks that are kind of becoming obsolete because they don't have the same impression on an audience.
Can you give me an example of that?
Well, I mean, what happens today is that, you might have seen a kind of mind reading act. For instance, if someone had taken a drawing, if you had taken a drawing years ago and put it in a locked box, okay, and then taken that drawing out of another box on the other side of the stage, you know, 100 years ago, that would have been 50 years ago, that would have been a fantastic illusion. Okay, now, of course, we recognize that as a fax machine. Now, that isn't how they were performing it. But what that means is that there's been some kind of science or some sort of technology that's supplanted that effect.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's made that kind of not impressive to anyone anymore.
Now, what would it have been in 50 years ago? How the trick would have been done?
Well, it wouldn't have been performed like that, of course. I mean, because that wasn't technology that magicians were using.
So it would have been like somebody underneath the stage walking it into the next, 50 feet into the other box?
It might have been in an elaborate setting. I mean, someone might have done something like that, or it might have been something much cleverer. The point is, though, that, you know, a kind of bald effect like that, an illusion like that, wouldn't necessarily just impress an audience anymore.
Fair enough. So then the other way of looking at that is that audiences are so much more sophisticated with technology and science, et cetera, that a magician proper can take advantage of that by manipulating the expectation of the audience for what that technology could do.
I agree with you. I agree with exactly what you said, except the part that magicians, that audiences are so much more sophisticated. And of course, what happens is that anything, any kind of belief system, any kind of understanding, or any kind of cultural system that the audience brings to the table can be used to deceive them.
Yeah, and against
this is, them. This is why, you know, this is when magicians investigate psychics and things like that, why scientists, ironically, can be mystified very easily. Because scientists aren't looking for those kinds of things. Scientists bring a very strict system of observations and beliefs to the table, and that's how they've been trained. And if someone's clever, they know how to, like jujitsu, they know how to turn that over and use it. And so the, kind of as long as anyone has a system that they bring to the table, as long as someone has beliefs and they have expectations, that's part of the formula that a magician can use.
So it's a little bit like...
I know I'm being vague because I don't
know. No.
How it's done.
I know you're going to be one of those. I totally get that. But I respect that, by the way. You know, I know that there are magicians that will talk about stuff and magicians who won't, and rarely the twain shall meet. But but it makes me think, though, that when it comes right down to it, is audiences or scientists lack that streak of the con man a little bit, like a clever magician would have. You use cleverness, and I think really more, it's almost like a level of sort of streetwise criminality that the scientists are somewhat naive or unsuspecting, and the magician is always a little bit more suspicious about how to make something appear to be something else.
I'd say that's probably true, yeah. You know, but of course, you know, and maybe this is a little bit of Freudian logic again, but you know, you can't just always draw the line there. You know, if you wanted to come up with something that just fooled magicians, you could do that as well. Because of course, magicians have a certain kind of expectation. There are things they're looking for in a formula as well. Even though they're experts, I think more expert in deception. When they watch these things, they also have expectations. And if you know what those are, then you can also subvert that. And con men have certain ways of doing things. And if someone's been raised in that area where they know how to have a con, then they're looking for certain beats of the formula that they always expect. And then you could fool them by using a different formula. So it's not simply that one group is always expert. And I think that's been proven over the years with magicians. There are magicians who have been very badly fooled in situations like this,
right?
Thinking that they knew exactly what was going on.
And there's a dotted line, though, between a street magician and a three-card Monty con man, where the somebody playing three-card Monty or hide the ball for $20, mm-hmm. they're a magician. They're doing kind of a magic trick, but there's also this great, like, sort of human engineering that they can do to somebody standing there to get them to get $20 out of their pocket. And I respect that in a magician. I think that's really cool how they seem to have a level of intuition which seems almost psychic under the circumstances.
I see what you mean. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I mean, there's no question that some of those people and some of those con men and now we'll widen it, you know, advertising executives and politicians and just keep going. There's certainly a level of expertise, and there are tricks in all of those fields that are expert tricks.
Yeah, but there's something about the eye-hand thing.
Oh, which, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Right? I mean, you get the ability to get somebody to focus their energies happily away from the very thing that's going to cost them $20. You know, I mean, that's what a con man can do it, and magicians can do it. And it's so cool. And I don't mind, you know, I was in New Orleans, and I was with a guy who was doing this for a living. And he's just right up front about, you know, he's going to try and find a way to get $5 from me for doing magic tricks. And I thought, there really isn't a difference. If he had said to me, I'm just going to, you don't have to pay me a cent, I just want to show you some magic tricks, he still would have ended up with my $5.
Right.
He was just nice enough to tell me in advance he's going to be taking my money from me. And I thought, okay. And then like a week later, I saw him on Letterman, and I thought, okay, this guy's good. He's really good.
Obviously. But, he's collected enough $5 to get to New York.
Oh yeah, well he makes so much money at during Mardi Gras that he just goes down there. He works the streets for Mardi Gras, makes a ton of money. But he's a regular, you know, touring magician / comedian. But he just can't turn down the money he can make on a Mardi Gras weekend.
There are really, really amazing sleight of hand magicians working today. I think in the last 20 years, there's really been a renaissance of that, and there are some real innovators, I think, of our generation. I think it's going to take a little time to see. We'll sort out exactly who the best of those are, but there's no question that this is really a kind of renaissance time for sleight of hand magic. They're just great, great state of the art magicians.
What do you think of Chris Angel? What do you think of these sort of cutting edge magician type performers?
Well, I mean, when you say cutting edge, you know, what you're talking about is the fact that what he's wearing and that he stands on the street.
There's something assaultive about him, which is different than, say, a David Copperfield, which to me is very reassuring and very sort of inviting. And there's something about the Chris Angel, and there's a couple other guys out there that do this, that sort of make you uncomfortable to be around him. Do you think?
Yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily an endorsement that you're uncomfortable being around the performer. But I do think that what Chris is doing and what a number of those performers are doing is really a different approach. It's about putting magic in a place that you don't expect to see it, and I think there's always a value to that, and it just opens up the performance possibilities to the magician.
Well, there's nothing soothing about him. In that sense, I mean, these sort of, it makes you,
no,
I just think.
No spangly vests, you mean?
Yeah, there's something very unnerving about Chris Angel. And I think that's interesting, or at least there is to me. And I think that's interesting because that's a different way of doing it than the suit and, you know, let's bring out Marla. And there's some nice woman with some great gams. And there's just nothing about those sort of familiar trappings with a lot of these magicians today.
I think that's right. I think that, you know, what you're responding to is kind of what started happening in Las Vegas, you know, when those shows were folded into those shows, to production shows for many years, when part of that was the production value as well. Because, you know, 75 years ago, 100 years ago, when you saw magicians very often, or even before that, hundreds of years ago, it really came off the street. It came out of those kind of improvised performances, which was about getting a little bit of money from somebody. And that's really how it started. And so in many ways, it's come full circle right now.
Again, we're talking with Jim Steinmeier, who is both a creator of magic, stage magic acts, as well as being a writer. And we'll get back to questions about 40 in times coming up after the top of the hour. And the author, Charles Fort, the book of the Damned. And we're talking about the biography that Jim wrote about Charles Fort. But all right. So when we're talking about magic, though, I got to go back to something that's sort of 40 in. Will there ever, what do you believe is the logic? Is there psychic abilities? Are there people who can use their minds to actually read cards, to actually do the things which we would like people to be able to do, but we suspect that they're faking it or they're dealing from the bottom of the deck? Is there anybody you know that can actually do that?
No, I've never run into that. Now, I don't consider myself, you know, a researcher in this field, and I don't seek those things out. But I also would say that certainly within the world of magic, that isn't a common occurrence. I will tell you an odd story, which has sort of fallen out of the history of magic. There used to be a thing in the 20s, which were mind reading acts. And I say this, you know, during the heyday of vaudeville. You know, there were a number of mind readers, and that was an act. You know, that mind reading act was an effect. The idea was that it was usually involved some sort of code between the performer and the person doing it. I don't think I'm exposing any vast secret here. They had very elaborate codes so that by asking a question or by conveying a little bit of information, they would convey other information to the person. And you know, you've seen this in films. Someone says, "What am I holding in my hand?" And they say, "You're holding a watch." What's interesting is that the people who really did these acts and did them all the time and, you know, did them every night, several performances a night, invariably, many of them had experiences that they thought were real psychic experiences, where they got information that they thought was coded to them and they realized later couldn't have been coded, that they said something extra and they were right. And they often puzzled over how it happened, that it was kind of two minds that were working together so closely that something genuinely magical happened, and that the deceivers were fooled. And there are several accounts of this about mind readers who fooled themselves doing this act because they didn't have a code that could have conveyed that information, and yet somehow they got it. And of course, there are a number of theories about how that could be happening. You know, one thing is that you really do have two minds that are working that closely, and there's a spark that goes, something happens magically between them. Another thing is that when you have two minds that are working that closely, when a coincidence occurs, when there's just a little bit of a jump in logic, you tend to overreact to that. But it is interesting that as far as any of the people I've talked to about this, that was kind of the most interesting example of magicians finding evidence of something strange happening within their own acts and something very unexpected.
You know, this happened to a guy I know who is a well-known preacher / evangelist. He's not a believer in miracle cures, and he tells this story about speaking. I think it was in St. Louis. And a mother came up to him afterward with her son, who was suffering from a well-known mental defect. I can't remember exactly what it was. And she asked him to pray on her son. And it just wasn't his thing. But he was kind of caught off guard. And he said he sort of stumbled through a blasphemous prayer where he was just saying stuff because he felt he had to, and he didn't want to be there, didn't want to be doing it, but didn't want to turn this woman away, and lo and behold, he felt something in the middle of this prayer, which he said he was just gonna offering pro forma to kind of get out of this awkward situation, and he felt something, and he, about a year later, 2 years later, he runs into that woman and that son was healed within like a day or two of that particular meeting. And she credits him with having been the person which did the healing prayer. And to this day, he said it freaks him out because he didn't feel like he did anything, and he doesn't even believe in it. Yeah. But he said he just can't get over the fact that he was talking to the boy and having the most normal conversation with this kid.
It's odd. It brings it back to that point that, you know, the greatest drug ever invented is the placebo, you know, because if they could only market the placebo,
right?
You know, because it does more good and never does any harm, you know, but somehow they can't get a patent for that. You know?
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, so then coming up here, we'll get back to discussions about Charles Fort and Fortean times. And I'm going to ask you to do what you did last hour, too, and pull out a couple of stories more from the Book of the Damned or from the other collected works of Charles Fort, stories which we're still talking about today, stories that still have, it seemed like, still have a thread that people are pursuing to this day. We'll find out whether anybody found that India story about it raining blood in India, and then recently having been proven that, in fact, it was real blood. And or magic, too, which we can get into with Jim Steinmeier. And I ask you to go to the website at coasttocoastam.com and link up to Jim right there. While you're there, you can take a look at the Christy Peel story from the first hour, or the investigation into the smiley face serial killers. And also click onto my blog. It's not quite magic. And it's something, though, that I think Charles Fort would greatly appreciate. It is a true story. It really happened to me, and there's the photo to prove it. And I took that photo. You'll see it at the end of the column. Go read my blog. Click on to coasttocoastam.com, and then look on the lower left-hand side of the screen, and it's right there. Just link up to it and take a look at it. coasttocoastam.com. Jim Steinmeier next for our last hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.